My name is Chad Pearson, and I'm joined with Theodore W. Allen, author of the two-volume The Invention of the White Race, Racial Oppression and Social Control, and The Origin of Racial Oppression in Anglo-America, published by Verso Press in 1994 and 1997, respectively. Taken together, these two volumes address over three centuries of racial oppression. Mr. Theodore Allen has also published essays in Monthly Review, Z Magazine, and Cultural Logic. Mr. Theodore Allen, thank you for joining us on Talking History.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Chad. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's begin with your personal background. Where did you grow up?
Well, the tenderest years, until I was 10, I lived in Indiana, southwestern Indiana, in a rural community. And then for the rest, I lived in Appalachia, Kentucky, and West Virginia.
I see. And you describe yourself in The Invention of the White Race, Volume 1, as an independent scholar. And I understand that you previously worked as a coal miner, a mail handler, an engineering draftsman, a teacher, and a librarian. Did your early employment experiences make you especially mindful of race or racism in American society?
Well, not as to the degree that it should have. I worked in the mines and organized the United Mine Workers Union, and there were black miners and white miners. But it wasn't until the experience of the civil rights struggles and the inspiration of the civil rights movement that I began to look at the labor movement with a critical eye regarding the decisive significance of white supremacism as a retarding factor and as an Achilles heel of the labor movement.
Can you talk a little bit about working as a coal miner? You mentioned that there were both black and white miners. Was work segregated there? Or?
Did they work together?
Were the workers segregated in the mines?
They weren't segregated in the mines, but they segregated in the bathhouses. Mm-hmm. You'd have a black side and a white side of the bath, where you went to change your clothes from the street clothes to the bank clothes, the miners' clothes. And then there was segregation in housing, pretty much, a great deal of it, where the better houses were generally, if the bottom was pretty wet and the hillside was pretty dry, then you'd probably find the black families on the bottom and the white families on the upper side. And if the situation was more favorable for living on the lower, on the bottom land, then you would have that. They had discrimination, all sorts of discrimination. The only thing the United Mine Workers held to was that, well, you know, we're all working here together and we have to belong to the same union. They learned that after a while. They didn't understand that at first. And so I was a miner. I was active in the union. I was a local union leader and president of a local. And I was aware of the need to oppose white supremacy. But in practical terms of dealing with the division of the white supremacism among white miners, they say, white workers in general, I was not active and alert as I now think I should have been at that time. I learned some things.
This was in Appalachia, and can you give us a time frame, roughly? When did you work in the mines?
I worked in the mines, in West Virginia, from 1939 to 1942, 4 years, parts of 4 years, and I was injured in the mine, to hurt my back in the mines, and I had to stop.
I understand. And you mentioned that there was racism and discrimination there. Were there efforts at the time to confront that racism in the United Mine Workers?
No, it was not. It was simply, well, we're all in a union, we have to stick together, fight as a union. And then there would be some cases where recognition was given to, I mean, for instance, in Dakota, which was a mining camp in Marion County, West Virginia. They had a rule, and this wasn't, there were other, many other instances of it, where the, you would have, if you had a mine committee, the mine committee was only three. It didn't matter how many people working in a mine or how few, there would be three mine committees. And they'd say, well, we'll have one American, one Negro, and one foreigner, right? So there was a rough sense of the need to distribute among, in some cases, of officers in the locals and so on. That was honored and practiced pretty well, and which that was a good thing, but it was a long way from the regional level of class consciousness that's about, with a historic, informed by history and so on, about the role played by white supremacism in the degradation of the working class as a whole. Well, there wasn't enough of that.
So there was white supremacism that found expression somehow in the coal mines?
Well,
and in the community?
Well, yeah, I mean, the communities were segregated. Of course, the company store, everybody went to. But the housing usually would be segregated. And then if you went to the county seat and went to the theater, you know, if the African Americans were admitted, they were only admitted to the gallery while the European Americans occupied below, or same thing with public accommodations in general. This is in West Virginia, which was southern state in a way. It's a border state, but you know, the segregation of the restaurants and bars and mostly pool rooms and the social life, and of course in the churches.
I want to talk about your major study, The Invention of the White Race. Can you tell our listeners, what do you mean by invention?
Contrivance. There's not natural. And if you say, you wouldn't say the invention of the human race, right? Because that's a biological, anthropological matter. But with the white race, that's an artificial identification, which is not, as I said someplace in one of the books, Europeans go from Europe, and in Europe, the anthropologists speak of many races in Europe, you know, the Mediterraneans and the Slavs and the Nordics and so on, different races. You read anthropology and the accounts such as Garn and Dobzhansky, And when, from multiracial Europe, in an anthropological sense, people go to South Africa or go to North America and incorporate themselves as the white race, that has nothing to do with evolution or anthropological transformation. It's a political act, and it is a contrivance, an invention, in the minds of some people, ruling class, which had been confronted with Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, in which 400 English and Negroes in arms, as in one case, that wasn't the only case, fought together for their freedom, and they were promised freedom from their slavery. And so there couldn't have been a white race then. And they would run away together, and they would fornicate together, and I mean, black and white, bond laborers, and poor free people. And so the white race could not have existed then because the white workers were not engaged in putting down or putting aside African Americans. The white race comes into being when the laboring class European Americans, by privileges and devices, make solidarity with the European American owning class to keep down the African American bond laborers and free people too as well. And that's what the white race is. It's the historically most general form of class collaboration.
And you're saying that the white race is invented in a period after Bacon's Rebellion, after
yes.
that uprising in 1676?
Yes, 1670. There was it was a crisis, a terrific crisis in Virginia, which was the main colony, and Maryland, too, was carved out of Virginia's side in 1634. But there was a crisis because there was a handful of big landowners who had appropriated the land. They had grants and so on, and then they had the privilege, if you imported a bond laborer, you got 50 acres for every bond laborer you imported, right? It didn't go to the bond laborer, it went to the one who imported them, whether black or white. That was in the 17th century. Later, they got away with that. And so those people who were bond laborers, who were limited-term bond laborers even, after a period of years, 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, whatever the term might be, were not able to find land and a way to live. They were given so many barrels of corn and a few clothes, and that was called their freedom dues, although it wasn't required by law. But they didn't have land. And so they were impoverished, and so social control broke down in under Governor Barclay in the 1670s. It had been kind of difficult up to then because of the attenuation of the intermediate stratum. There were too few of the intermediate stratum, that is, small owners and lifetime leaseholders, there were very few, and the masses of the people were joined in that Bacon's Rebellion, even though it started out as a quarrel among the owners within the owning class between those who were on the frontier and those who were near the Tidewater regions of Virginia. And at a certain point, with The accidental factors, Bacon and his Nathaniel Bacon, he was one of the ruling class, and he was a frontier, and he broke with them. Started out as a difference over Indian policy, but before it was over, it became predominantly made up of bond laborers and people recently out of the time, black and white. And that's when Captain Gransom on the merchant ship Concord went up the York River, and there I found 400 English and Negroes in arms. Some were for shooting me, and some were for cutting me in pieces. No right white race there, right? So, because that was them. And the story of, you know, of how that impoverishment. But the other part of the story is this, that the king, Charles II by that time, sent an expedition to put down the rebellion. It took them 11 months for the time they first heard about it, so they got to the forces of Virginia. By that time, the rebellion was over. And but that what that meant was that social control could not be maintained on that old basis. You had to bring in an army. Well, to have to bring in an army is prohibitively expensive. So how do you have social control? Well, you don't have enough of the intermediate strata of the small owners. You have small tenant farmers and bond laborers, so you promote them to the white race. Doesn't involve becoming owners of property, but you could carry a gun, you could get married, you could move about freely, you could be a witness in a trial, you could bring charges. Elementary rights, civil rights, which was common in England, English rights, but here they were made white skin privileges because African Americans could not carry a gun, generally, with some exceptions, get married, and move about freely, I mean, and so on. And another special feature of those privileges was this, peculiarly American. The ruling classes, employing classes, have traditionally exploited women of the working, laboring classes, sexually exploited them. So that was true of the slaveholders, as you know. But what was done with this invention of the white race was to give to the poorest, low down, this European American, now called white, to assume familiarity with any African American, free or black, free or white, free or bond. And that has come down to us to this day. And that's peculiar. That wasn't true in England. There wasn't a group of laboring, exploited people who were given province of privilege over the women of another class of laboring people. That was one of the aspects of that invention.
So the white race is invented in struggle.
Yes, it was the answer to the problem of social control. As you may read in chapter 2, the governor of Maryland said, well, if some way not be found to reconcile, you know, to bring harmony between the owners and the common people, then we'll have another Bacon's Rebellion. He mentioned Bacon especially. And so what was it? Well, find common ground with the poor whites. Not the common people, but the common people came to mean, when you say common people, I mean white people, right? That's the general thing. And they were, and in order to seal that bargain, they were given racial privileges with respect to African Americans. they may not get land, but they could move to the frontier, right? They could go to another county. They could squat. African Americans in general couldn't do that.
You mentioned the Homestead Act of 1862 as an example of
yeah, the Homestead. People, well, the struggle over the land, I mean, the issue of the land went on because under capitalism, even the United States was peculiar in that, assuming the extinction of the rights of the Indians, the public domain was there, right, to call it the public domain. And unlike other places, it wasn't previously owned by any private property-owning class. This was common land among the Indians. And so they, and the demand always of the laboring class European-Americans was to say, well, we want land, give us land. And in the early part of the 19th century, particularly with the overpopulation of the cities due to immigration, the great influx of immigrants, there was terrible misery in the cities. Philadelphia, New York, and Boston had a life expectancy in the 1830s, which was less than that of the bond labor, African-American bond laborers, about 6 years. Life was terrible. And they were terrible unemployment, suffering terribly. And the panacea that was put up by some labor leaders was free land, give us land. You know, that'll be a safety valve. Of course, Frederick Jackson Turner used to use that term, Frederick, safer land, free land safety valve. But it was not very realistic for expect ordinary workers to be able to do that because the cost of homesteading was prohibitive. If you're working for $1.50 a day and it takes $1 to move out there, then you have to be there 5 years and buy equipment. And so relatively very few people could even get homestead. But when they did, most of them didn't perfect their plant, their patents. You have a patent for so many years, and if you perform and build, then you can have the land. But most of them didn't finish it. Then after that, the railroads and the banks and the mining companies, especially the banks and railroads, took their mortgages and foreclosed on it. But that was an idea. And in 1862, there had been homestead bills quite a few times before in Congress. And it was opposed generally by the property classes, but it was particularly opposed by the Southern slaveholders because to them, to allow homesteaders would mean to foreclose that land to the development of a slave economy, a plantation economy, be based on free labor and small operations. So they opposed it. And so that Homestead Act was enacted in 1862, but it too was a white skin privilege because it said, we grant this homestead right to American citizens and those who expect to become citizens. Well, African Americans were not citizens, didn't become citizens until after the 15th Amendment. And so, but it was the form of the white skin privilege. But the most, I hope I'm not making this answer too long, but after the Civil War, the African Americans rose up demanding land. They said, we fought in this war, we want land, we've made this land prosperous. And so there's a great movement for it. And there was, even among the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, there were those who thought, well, after the war, we'll break up the plantations and have small holders, black and white. And there was Thaddeus Stevens introduced the bill, Charles Sumner and George Washington Julian did likewise, fought for this cause. And what is interesting is that if that land reform in the South, homesteading in the South, had become general so that the African-American farm agricultural population would have as much chance to become landowners as the laboring population of the European Americans, then that would have been an end to racial oppression, because that would have broken the bars to social mobility. One of the characteristics of racial oppression is the denial of social mobility, right? To you can't acquire, you can't go into business, you can't own, and so on. And that would have been a revolutionary step towards social mobility if you had 100,000 African-American bond laborers on those old plantations' lands and broken up the plantations. I'm writing about that now in my current critique of labor history, but I'll stop with that.
The invention of the white race came out at a time when a number of other academics published books about race relations, and more specifically about whiteness studies and white identity. How does your work differ from some of the other books, the other works on race and whiteness?
Well, the contribution made by the white studies thing, in my opinion, is that it objectified white identity, didn't take it for granted. You know, that's the white word, that's the way they are, right? No, I said, no, that's an identity which historically developed or socially constructed, called a social construct. And that is, I mean, the alternative to that is the biological interpretation of race identity, right? Well, you can't do anything about that, right? So that was the value of that. Now, the earlier effort to break that, cut the Gordian knot between biology and anthropology and history and economics, was with the Communist Party, with the Negro question to the national question idea. That transformed it from an anthropological question to a historical category. And that was helpful. The only trouble is, the corollary of it was that the white workers have to have a special obligation of fighting white supremacy among the white workers. I mean, white communists, revolutionaries, class-conscious workers have a special responsibility. But in the course of the New Deal, this was sort of put on the back burner, and so you got a theory like this. Well, yes, the Negro question, the national question, and it'll be solved in time, with the socialist revolution, right? Later for you, right? No good, because you never get there that way, let alone being wrong to say in the first place, but you couldn't get there that way. So here was another idea, which the white identity, the whiteness of the social construct, helps along that way, think objectively about what the white identity means. But if I might read briefly from here, the thesis of race as a social construct as it now stands, despite its value in objectifying whiteness, is an insufficient basis for refutation of white supremacist apologetics and for advancing, quote, the abolition of whiteness, which is Rodriguez's phrase. The logic must be tightened and the focus sharpened, just as it is unhelpful, to say the least, to euphemize racial slavery in continental Anglo-America as the peculiar institution, instead of identifying the white race itself as the peculiar institution governing the life of the country after emancipation as it did in slavery times. Just as it is not race, in quotes, in general, that must be understood, but the white race in particular, so the white race must be understood not simply as a social construct, but rather as a genetic, rather than a genetic phenomenon, but as a ruling class social control formation. That is my criticism. That's the difference that I have with, all right, Rodiger.
And, this is David Rodiger?
Yeah, David R. Rodiger, the author of, for instance, Wages of Whiteness. He's written many things. And he gave a favorable review of my book, incidentally, which I'm indebted to him for. But, and also my, I have my differences with the Canadian. And then those who introduce whiteness, I shy away from that term whiteness as being not, I mean, that's an abstract noun. It's an abstraction. It's an attribute of some people. It's not the role they play. And the white race is an actual objective thing. It's not anthropology. It's a historically developed identity of European Americans in Anglo-America. And it's and so it has to be dealt with. It functions. It is, exists, really functions in this history of ours. And it has to be recognized as such. I mean, perhaps that was thought to be somewhat captious, but to me, the whiteness, to slough it off under the heading of whiteness, seems to get away from the basic white race identity problem. Although not all, I'm not rebuking or disagreeing with everybody who uses that term, because many, much good work has been done under that heading. That's my difference, though, with them.